All right. So we're in a little section here. It probably the exciting or the one that we know, the story that we know is in the second half of this chapter. But we talked last week about Solomon's sin. Now we're starting to see the repercussions of that sin. And then we see the ultimate repercussions of that in the split of the kingdom in the second half of the chapter. And that's what we'll get to next week. There's just really no way you can cover all this and the splitting, the prophecy, and all that that's going to happen with the kingdom after that. But we are winding down with Solomon. And we talked about pride being Solomon's sin last week. That is what ultimately is going to lead him to idolatry. It's ultimately what's going to lead him to fornication and all these different sins that he falls into with the women and with the money and material things and going away from God. And so I thought I would read, open us up a little bit with some C.S. Lewis this morning. I got a couple of C.S. Lewis fans in the room. If you haven't read Mere Christianity, you should. It's just a great basic apologetic for the faith. But he has a chapter on pride. And so I thought I'd read a little bit of that chapter because I think he does a great description of what this pride is in the Christian life. The title of the chapter is The Great Sin. That is the sin that leads to all other sins in Lewis's mind. So he says, I now come to that part of Christian morals where they differ most sharply from all other morals. There is one vice of which no man in the world is free, which everyone in the world loathes when he sees it in someone else, and of which hardly any people except Christians ever imagine they are guilty of themselves. I have heard people admit that they are bad-tempered, or that they cannot keep their heads about girls, or drink, or even that they are cowards. I do not think I have ever heard anyone who was not a Christian accuse himself of this vice. And at the same time, I have very seldom met anyone who was not a Christian who showed the slightest mercy to it in others. There is no fault which makes a man more unpopular, and no fault which we are more unconscious of in ourselves. And the more we have it ourselves, the more we dislike it in others. The vice I'm talking of is pride or self-conceit, and the virtue opposite in Christian morals is called humility. You may remember when I was talking about sexual morality, I warned you that the center of Christian morals did not lie there. Well, now we have come to the center. According to Christian teachers, the essential vice, the utmost evil, is pride. Unchastity, anger, greed, drunkenness, and all that are mere flea bites in comparison. It was through pride that the devil became the devil. Pride leads to every other vice. It is the complete anti-God state of mind. Does this seem to you exaggerated? If so, think it over. I pointed out a moment ago that the more pride one had, the more one disliked pride in others. In fact, if you want to find out how proud you are, the easiest way is to ask yourself, how much do I dislike it when other people snub me, or refuse to take notice of me, or shove their oar in, or patronize me, or show off? The point is that each person's pride is in competition with everyone else's pride. It is because I wanted to be the big noise at the party that I am so annoyed at someone else being the big noise. Two of a trade never agree. Now, what you want to get clear is that pride is essentially competitive. It's competitive by its very nature, while the other vices are competitive only, so to speak, by accident. Pride gets no pleasure out of having something, only out of having more of it than the next man. We say that people are proud of being rich or clever or good-looking, but they are not. They're proud of being richer or cleverer or better-looking than others. If everyone else became equally rich or clever or good-looking, there would be nothing to be proud about. It is the comparison that makes you proud, the pleasure of being above the rest. So think about Solomon and the other kings. Once the element of competition is gone, pride is gone. That's why I say that pride is essentially competitive in a way that other vices are not. The sexual impulse may drive two men into competition if they both want the same girl, but that is only by accident. They might just as likely have wanted two different girls. But a proud man will take your girl from you, not because he wants her, but just to prove to himself that he's a better man than you. Greed may drive men into competition if there is not enough to go around, but the proud man, even when he has gotten more than he can possibly want, will try to get still more just to assert his power. Nearly all those evils in the world which people put down to greed or selfishness are really far more the result of pride. Okay? And then I want to read this last paragraph. It says, it is a terrible thing that the worst of all the vices can smuggle itself into the very center of our religious life. But you can see why. The other and less bad vices come from the devil working on us through our animal nature. But this does not come through our animal nature at all. It comes direct from hell. It is purely spiritual. Consequently, it is far more subtle and deadly. For the same reason, pride can often be used to beat down the simpler vices. Teachers, in fact, often appeal to a boy's pride, or as they call it, his self-respect, to make him behave decently. Many a man has overcome cowardice or lust or ill temper by learning to think that they are beneath his dignity, that is, by pride. The devil laughs.
He is perfectly content to see you becoming chaste and brave and self-controlled, provided all the time he is setting you up in the dictatorship of pride. Just as he would be quite content to see your chilblains cured if he was allowed in return to give you cancer. For pride is spiritual cancer. It eats up the very possibility of love or contentment or even common sense. So that's C.S. Lewis on pride. Okay. I think it's one of his better chapters. I think he nails it. Because everything we do in a pride sense is out of selfishness. It is, there is nothing good can be done out of that self-centered pride. There's never anything good when I come first, from a biblical perspective. So that's what Solomon is suffering through, and now we're going to see the repercussions of that. Okay? So let's start in verse 9. If you remember, all the sins were at the beginning of this chapter and all the wives. And so now the Lord responds to Solomon's sin. And the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice and had commanded him concerning this thing, that he should not go after other gods. But he did not keep what the Lord commanded. Therefore, the Lord said to Solomon, since this has been your practice and you have not kept my covenant and my statutes that I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom from you and will give it to your servant. Yet for the sake of David, your father, I will not do it in your days, but I will tear it out of the hand, out of your hand in the next day, or out of the hand of your son. Sorry. However, I will not tear away all the kingdom, but I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem that I have chosen. So obviously this is going to come into play later on in the chapter much more vividly, but it's a hint of what's to come here at the beginning. So we got kind of like this two-faced kind of situation going on here. Solomon is David's chosen heir, but how does he come to power? He has to kind of kill off all his rivals to get there, if you remember that in chapter 2. Nathan supports him in chapter 1. After Solomon comes to the throne, you never hear another prophetic voice in the rest of these chapters. He's not consulting prophets like Nathan did for David. Prayer for wisdom to rule righteously, that's where he gets the wisdom in 3 and 4. He gets wealth for himself and horses and gold in chapters 9 and 10. He completes and dedicates the temple, but then he is worshiping other idols because of his foreign wives. And then the Lord is supporting Solomon in chapter 9 after the temple is done. And then we get to chapter 11 where the Lord rejects Solomon. So he is really one side of the coin or the other when we look at Solomon's story, especially when we get to chapter 11. So as we go back to last week, of all the sins recorded, that should be an ED, in the Old Testament, God takes idolatry the most seriously. And I think that's why sometimes we'll read the Old Testament and we're like, I don't know how this applies to me, because I don't worship idols. And yet we do, obviously, just not in the same way that Solomon did. No other sin has the capability of wrecking the entire covenant all by itself. When idolatry is committed, God acts swiftly, justly, and redemptively. If you want to read some stories about that, read Exodus 32, 34, Numbers chapter 20. There's some fiery serpents coming into the congregation in that sense. And the entire book of Judges is that whole cycle. You know, idolatry, God goes away, they come back to God, he comes back and sends in a judge, and that whole cycle over and over and over again in the book of Judges. So the Lord's anger in this passage isn't surprising. He revealed himself to Solomon, he blessed Solomon, he honored Solomon, he told him word for word, this is what you need to do to succeed, and yet Solomon chased the idols. And so God now has to, you know, lay the smackdown as it were. So in return, Solomon has turned away from the Lord. He got blessing, he got support, he got confirmation of what he was doing, and he still turned away. That's why he's in the situation he's in. That's why Israel will be in the situation that they're in. So God speaks to Solomon again, and unlike the previous three times we've seen this, the Lord now comes down pretty hard on him. His past instructions, here's one example in 1 Kings 9, 4. If you will walk before me as David your father walked, with integrity of heart and uprightness, doing according to all that I have commanded, and keeping my statutes and my rules, then I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever. Remember, we kind of covered this idea. The covenant is with David. The permanence of the throne is with David. Everybody that follows David has to follow the rules. If you do that, you will be removed. You will face the consequences. David's covenant still stands. Obviously, we're going to see that fulfilled in Jesus. But Solomon doesn't have that covenant. Solomon has to follow the rules. And once he starts worshiping idols, God's going to move his blessing away from him very quickly. Okay? There's a parallel here with Saul back in 1 Samuel 13. When Saul is told, "You have done foolishly. You have not kept the command of the Lord your God with which he commands you. For then the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be prince over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." And then 1 Kings 11, it says, "Since this has been your practice, and you have not kept my covenant, my statutes that I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom from you and will give it to your servant." So this kingdom is going to be taken from you, just like Saul did, because Saul would not follow God's will. Kingdom is taken. Solomon will not walk in the steps of his father David. Kingdom gets taken from him.
David, can I ask a question?
Go ahead.
Maybe somebody remembers. I don't. Did King David have the Lord speak directly to him the way Solomon did?
I don't know if we have a record just like that.
I'm trying to think. Why David had Nathan, and Nathan was not there for Solomon.
Right.
Is it because he wasn't needed? Because Solomon had supposedly this direct relationship?
Yeah, that's a good thought.
It said that the Lord was with them always, and so that's why Saul, when David was around, felt calm, because the Lord was with David. So Saul was happier, but then that changed. But anyway, so I don't think he spoke to him, but it was more of I felt his presence, so I have loved him.
Yeah, I don't know, because during David's lifetime, you've got Samuel and then Nathan that are, very clearly speaking for the Lord, and then you don't have that with Solomon. That's a good thought. I'll go back and look at that. I don't know if there's one. I don't know if David gets these. I mean, I think David had obviously a very close communion with God, and he got a lot of words from God. He wrote the Psalms. I don't know if we've got a direct.
Yeah, I always see David as being the young man of faith.
Yeah.
He didn't need to see to believe. He already believed, and therefore God revealed himself to him in ways. And it's different with
maybe the temple has something to do with that. Because you've got a dwelling, you've got a holy of holies. And during David's time, we don't have the temple and the tabernacles that's jointed. So I don't know. It's a good question. Investigate that further. So only one thing is keeping Solomon on the throne at this point. If Solomon deserves to be booted out. He deserves to be fired, Donald Trump style and everything. You are fired. Or Vince McMahon, if you like that. But the promise the Lord made to David in 2 Samuel 7, "When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you. He shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of the kingdom forever." So if God had not promised, "I'm going to put your son on the throne," Solomon would already be gone. So he's going to allow Solomon to live out his days on the throne until afterwards, and then the punishment will be done. But then if we look at 2 Samuel 7:14, look at what God says. He says, "I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. When he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with the rod of men, with the stripes of the sons of men." So God said, "I'm going to be his father. And he will be my son, but when he breaks the covenant, I will discipline him." Now, this is an interesting parallel, because if you look at this verse in Chronicles, this part's not there. Because when they write Chronicles, this has already happened, and they're looking forward to the next son, which Messiah. That's what they're looking forward to, and they know Messiah doesn't need the discipline. But Solomon needs the discipline. It's another fulfilled prophecy. And so we'll see how that works continually with Solomon's discipline in this chapter. And I think the Lord shows mercy as well, because he doesn't just strike Solomon down on the spot. He allows him to, because he said, "I'm going to put your son on the throne." He will live out his days on the throne.
He also separates Israel.
Yes, and that's ultimately going to be. Which there's some different, that's obviously a punishment for Solomon. And Israel is more prone to idolatry and drifting, and they all are, but Israel's worse than Judah. They always kind of have been. We'll talk more about that as we look at the map and stuff as we go forward. Okay, so for David's sake, the Lord allows Solomon to stay in power, and David's descendants will continue to rule a fragment of the nation. So you don't get to rule the whole kingdom anymore. I'm going to break this kingdom apart, but you're still going to keep, he says, a tribe. Obviously, we get a tribe, but Benjamin kind of, and Simeon was kind of absorbed by Judah, and you got Benjamin, and that's really interesting when Benjamin comes in, because remember, Saul's from Benjamin, and they're are not always the greatest. Got some problems with Benjamin throughout the Old Testament. But despite these mercies, the punishment is clear, irrevocable, and stunning considering the prosperity in the previous chapters. It's really, like I said last week, it's that literary kind of punch in the face, because it's just prosperity, 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 and then all of a sudden Solomon goes off the rails and has 700 wives and 300 concubines, you know, and starts worshiping other gods and builds high places on the Mount of Olives, and all of a sudden, it just gets really bad really quickly. It escalates quite quickly. Okay, so Solomon's sin is going to cause Israel's downfall, and Solomon's idolatry is going to lead to idolatry among the people. Remember, we talked about that last week. So goes the king, so goes the nation, right? If the king is not following God, why would the people follow God? Why would they feel compelled? You know, it's just like anything else. If you've ever had that leader or that boss that doesn't do his job and then tries to get on you for not doing your job, it's really hard to get motivated to do your job at that point. You have to really dig into yourself to do that, because your boss isn't doing the job. And that's what's going on with Solomon. So you can't really go out and tell the nation, hey, you guys need to stop worshiping idols and be holy. Like Solomon, you just build high places within eyesight of the temple. You know, don't come at me with that kind of stuff. You can do what I can do it too. So Israel's begun the long road to exile, though they don't know yet what their actions will result in. But remember earlier in the book, Solomon prays, when we rebel against you and we sin against you, and you take us out of this land because we have sinned against you. Remember, he prophesied the exile. Forgive us when we repent. So it should be in their mind, but it's not. I think it's the hard-heartedness of Israel. It's the same reason why when Jesus comes on the scene, Israel should be looking for the Messiah at that point. You know, the math from Daniel, they should be looking for the Messiah, and they're not. You know, the miracles are there, the signs are there, the circumstances are there, but their hearts are so hard they won't acknowledge what the truth is. So even though they know if we keep sinning, God's going to punish us, and ultimately He can take us out of this land, they don't want to acknowledge that that's a possibility.
It's the same self-deception that C.S. Lewis was talking about. And the pride will do that to you.
Yeah, I can convince myself that I'm above all this. Yeah, he won't. And that's Israel, right? We're God's covenant people. He won't really do that. I know he said he's going to do that, and I know he's a just God, and I know he's perfect, and I know he can't put up with sin, but he couldn't possibly take out of this land.
He can do that to me.
I mean, exactly.
The Pharisees and said that.
Yeah, we're special, you know. We have revelation. We know the law. There's no way he's gonna do this to us. Yeah, exactly. You know, and that's the mindset.
Yeah, we're America.
Yeah, there you go. We're America. How about that? Yeah, same thing. Okay. So in 1 Kings 5:4, Solomon told Hiram, But now the Lord my God has given me rest. You can't see the picture, so don't even worry about it. But now the Lord my God has given me rest on every side. There is neither adversary nor misfortune. Well, now there is. He had just said, you know, God has blessed me. There's no enemies. It's peaceful. You know, we got good relationships with everybody. You know, well, it's all about to change very quickly. All right. So just because God leaves Solomon on the throne doesn't mean Solomon doesn't get punished. Doesn't mean he's not going to face some consequences here for his actions. God is going to raise up a couple adversaries, and this isn't the most exciting portion, but I think it tells you what's starting to happen around Solomon. It has been absolutely peaceful. Nobody has attacked. Since David's days, nobody has even messed with Israel. There hasn't been a skirmish on the border, it seems like. Everything has been very peaceful. You know, he's got political alliances with everybody in the general area, because he's married 700 of their daughters, you know, so he should be in good with every king all the way around. And you've got two guys that are going to rise up. You know, not guys that made alliances with Solomon, but two guys that are going to return to these lands that actually had dealings with David, bad dealings with David, and are going to rise up against Solomon. And the Bible makes it very clear that the Lord raises these guys up. You know, the Lord uses enemy nations, pagan guys, to punish Israel for what's going on. Book of Judges is the exact same way. Pretty much the whole of the Babylonian exile and the Assyrian exile is the exact same thing. Right? God is using enemy people. God is in charge of the enemies just as he is in charge of God's people. Remember in Isaiah, he calls Cyrus of Persia my anointed, which is the same word for Christ. My anointed Cyrus will come down, you know, and he will put your nose, hooks in your nose like oxen or something like this, some kind of vivid imagery like that, and he will drag you by the nose. That my anointed Cyrus, the pagan king, you know, Nebuchadnezzar, whoever you want to throw into that idea, Darius, all these guys that served God's purposes.
all the Esther stuff that that Pastor Sean's been talking about in the last month or so. God is using pagan situations and pagans, kings to get his will done. Okay? So God's going to raise up an adversary, an Edomite named Hadad, to oppose Solomon. And there's some recent history here. Back in 2 Samuel chapter 8, it says, "And David made a name for himself when he returned from striking down 18,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. Then he put garrisons in Edom. Throughout all Edom he put garrisons, and all the Edomites became David's servants, and the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went." So we'll see in the next section when we read it that Hadad was the only surviving member of Egypt's royal family. David killed everybody else in his family. This guy got out the back door and ran to Egypt. And he, as a young person, and he kind of found sanctuary down there. It's understandable that this guy grew up in Egypt hating Israel,
right.
Hating David, and obviously hating the son of David, because they killed his entire family. They took his kingdom away, and he's going to be coming back. All right? So let's look at this section of it first. Verse 14. "And the Lord raised up an adversary against Solomon, Hadad the Edomite. He was of the royal house in Edom, for when David was in Edom and Joab, the commander of the army," remember Joab, "went to bury the slain, he struck down every male in Edom," which if you know Joab is very Joab. He would do things like that. "For Joab and all Israel remained there 6 months until he had cut off every male in Edom. But Hadad fled to Egypt together with certain Edomites of his father's servants, Hadad still being a little child. They set out from Midian and came to Paran and took men with them from Paran and came to Egypt to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, who gave him a house and assigned him an allowance of food and gave him land. And Hadad found great favor in the sight of Pharaoh, so that he gave him in marriage the sister of his own wife, the sister of Tapenes the queen. And the sister of Tapenes bore him Genubath, the son whom Tapenes weaned in Pharaoh's house. And Genubath went in Pharaoh's house among the sons of Pharaoh. But when Hadad heard in Egypt that David slept with his fathers, and that Joab, the commander of the army, was dead, Hadad said to Pharaoh, 'Let me depart, that I may go to my own country.' But Pharaoh said to him, 'What have you lacked with me that you are now seeking to go to your own country?' And he said to him, 'Only let me depart.'" He's almost kind of a Moses there, growing up in Pharaoh's court. You know? There's some parallels here. Just let me go. We'll come back and look at these last couple verses here in a second. So, apparently, Pharaoh had no problem nurturing and protecting Hadad, while at the same time maintaining relations with Solomon. Remember, Solomon is married to Pharaoh's daughter. So talk about a political guy that's playing all sides. He's housing a guy that's an enemy. Yeah, it's awkward. He's housing a guy that's an enemy of Solomon at the same time that his daughter is married to Solomon. You know, there's some political stuff going on here. I think it's almost like he keeps this guy in his back pocket, just in case he needs him if things with Solomon go bad. Okay, so Solomon's married to his daughter. Eventually, Hadad returns home to harass Solomon, who can no longer expect total cooperation from the vassal state of Edom. Edom is now going to rebel. Okay, so the fight with Edom goes way back, all the way back to a womb with Jacob and Esau. They're not recognizable in that picture, but that's who they are.
Well, remember, they
need to be red, I guess. But they were fighting all the way back to the womb. So when you hear Edom, think Esau. Okay? When you hear Israel, think Jacob. So this battle with Edom goes all the way back to Jacob and Esau. So we're going pretty far back in the history of things. Right? Edom, in the New Testament, you'll see it as Idumea. Okay, same place. So if you're reading the New Testament, you see about something happening in Idumea, this is Edom. Okay, Jacob and Esau. Edom refuses Israel passage in Numbers 20. Remember, Moses brings the Israelites up and they want to pass through Edom. And the king of Edom says, you're not coming through here. You've got to go around. I think I've got a map up here somewhere. I'll show you where Edom is exactly. But Saul fights against Edom. Remember, Doeg the Edomite was working for Saul. He's the one that killed all the priests at Nob. When they wouldn't do what Saul wanted to do. Remember, he tried to get his soldiers to do it. They wouldn't do it. So this guy steps up, slaughters all the priests. David defeats the Edomites in 2 Samuel 8. You read that passage. And then apparently, based on what Obadiah says, Edom stood by and maybe even helped out when Babylon took Jerusalem. It says they laughed. You know, they stood along and did nothing when Jerusalem was taken. And it says they stood in the byways. They stood in the highways and wouldn't let the Israelites escape. So apparently they cut off the roads and delivered them right back to Babylon. And Obadiah condemns Edom for their, going against the people of God. So
Jacob and Esau, Israel and Edom, long history. In the New Testament, Israel is still going to be dealing with the sons of Esau because all the Herods are from Idumea. So it's a very interesting idea when you think about the that Friday morning when Jesus is delivered over to Herod Antipas after being with Pilate. That is a son of Jacob standing before a son of Esau, even right there in the New Testament. Okay. So now we get a second adversary. Let's read the last three verses of the chapter. God also raised up as an adversary to him Rezon, son of Eliada, who had fled from his master Hadadezer, king of Zobah, and he gathered men about him and became leader of a marauding band after the killing by David. And they went to Damascus and lived there and made him king in Damascus. He was an adversary of Israel all the days of Solomon, doing harm as Hadad did, and he loathed Israel and reigned over Syria. So this guy, just like David, he was kind of this leader of a rebel band. He kind of lived in the hills and he made a name for himself and rose to prominence in Syria. Later he takes control of Damascus, major city in the Middle East, capital of Syria today. You probably wouldn't want to go there today. You probably wouldn't last too long before ISIS came and got you, because they're, or whoever else is in control in that area. And there's recent history with this as well in that same 2 Samuel chapter 8. David also defeated Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, the king of Zobah, as he went to restore his power at the river Euphrates, that's up north. And David took from him 1,700 horsemen, 20,000 foot soldiers. David hamstrung all the chariot horses, but left enough for 100 chariots. And when the Syrians of Damascus came to help Hadadezer, king of Zobah, David struck down 22,000 men of the Syrians. Then David put garrisons in Aram of Damascus, and the Syrians became servants to David and brought tribute, and the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went. And David took the shields of gold that were carried by the servants of Hadadezer and brought them to Jerusalem and from Beta and from Berathai, cities of Hadadezer. King David took very much bronze, and David had defeated the whole army of Hadadezer. So both of these guys have had family members and armies totally destroyed by David. They've been taken out of commission. Now they're still around, and they're going to come back and get a little bit of vengeance on Solomon. So David's destruction of Syrians sparked a hatred for Israel and Rezon, similar to that of Hadad. Together they posed an ongoing threat to Israel's interests in Solomon's last 10 years on the throne. So Rezon was Solomon's troublemaker in the north, and Hadad caused problems in the south. I think I've got a map coming soon. But Syria.
Okay, so you hear Syria. We know there's a modern Syria. That's roughly where ancient Syria was as well. You'll hear it called Bashan in the Old Testament. So if you're ever reading that, that's Syria. Or Aram, the Arameans. Those are the Syrians. Okay, that's that. Now, later on, Assyria will come and take that whole area. And they'll absorb the whole kingdom of Syria. But for now, that's what it is. So David defeated Syria, 2 Samuel 8. So that's the only thing that's passed. In the future, we'll see Ahab's going to fight against Syria. He's going to have stuff with them. And Syria's actually going to be pretty successful against the kingdom of Israel. They're going to come in and take some things. There's a at Dan, way up north, at Tel Dan, there's a stone that they found from Syria, from Ben-Hadad, that talks about him defeating Israel. And it's a broken stele. It's kind of a memorial. And what you think probably happened was Israel took back that city, and when they found that stone, they broke it to say, yeah, he thought he had it. But the reason why that's an important stone archaeologically is because it says they have defeated Israel and the house of David. And it's great evidence, archaeological evidence, that people recognize the kingdom of David. It wasn't just a regional kingdom like some people try to make it out to be. But Syria sieges Samaria in 2 Kings. Syria battles Israel throughout 2 Kings. The kingdom is ultimately absorbed into Assyria. And Jesus ministers in Syria. I don't know if you've ever picked that up, but Jesus actually goes into Syria to minister in Matthew chapter 4. And in Mark 7, he's at least close because he's dealing with the Syro-Phoenician woman. That Syro is Syria. So he's very close there. And even when he's up in Caesarea Philippi, Mount Horeb and all that, he's real close. He's in the suburbs of Syria when he goes up to those places. There you go. Syria's important too. So here's your kingdom. Here is Edom. It's down in this area. Now, in the New Testament, it'll kind of come up here. It'll be about right here. In the Old Testament, it's this area down here. That's Edom. Here is Syria up here. Here's Zobah that was being talked about. So here's your Syrian kingdom, Damascus. There's a Damascus gate in Jerusalem because it points north. If you want to go to Damascus, you go out the Damascus gate. All right, not so much anymore, but in ancient days, that one pointed north. That was the Damascus gate. Okay. All right, so next week, we'll get more rebellion.
There will be more and more, and as more people rise against Solomon, it becomes easier to rise against Solomon, and it's going to come from inside his own kingdom. I'll take that away before Christ so you can focus. All right. So, we'll 5 minutes early today, have a little fellowship before we get out of here, because next week's when it gets really exciting. It's not good for Israel, but it's a fun text to go through and teach and see what's going on. So, any final comments on that? Pretty good on that. Don't worship idols. that's one thing. And leadership's important. And
you'd made a comment about pride, obviously, at the beginning.
Yep.
And I remember we had a chaplain in our church in Germany, and he said he wouldn't even tell his own kids that he was proud of them because he didn't feel that pride in them. And so instead, he used, I'm excited to see what God has done in your life.
Yeah.
That's always made a big impression on me because, we use that so freely. We tell our kids, I'm so proud of you. And, again, it instills that sin of pride because, you want your parents to be proud of you.
Yeah, as a parent, you want your kids to be better than somebody else.
Exactly.
That's a delicate fence to deal with, right?
It really is.
Yeah. Yes. Everybody gets a trophy, right? Don't get me started on that. All right. James was watching Mickey Mouse Clubhouse this morning, and it was something about some race, and it was like, where everybody's a winner. And I was like, we need to turn this off right now. We need to learn a lesson. Everybody's not a winner. Okay? They even let Pete be the winner, and he's just trying to wreck the whole race. It's not cool. All right, let's close out in a word of prayer. Father, thank you for today, Lord. Thank you for this time, and just to have a little fun as well, and to get into your word and have some fellowship here together. Help us to guard our hearts against pride, Lord, how easy it is to make its way in, and how unconsciously sometimes we can participate in a sin like that, and I know that does not give you glory. Pray that we'd be more cognizant of that. We would work very hard to keep those vices out of our lives. Be with the 10:45 service, Lord, again. Be with our youth service tonight. We thank you for all that you do for us. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you, guys.